From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Democrat Joe Biden is in Washington today to pay his respects to the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is the first woman to lie in state in the Capitol Rotunda. Meanwhile, President Trump is on the road. He's campaigning today in Florida, Georgia, and Virginia.
And there are serious doubts this week whether President Trump will accept a peaceful transfer of power after the election. Even some Republicans are concerned. Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now. Jesse Holland is a weekend host at C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Hi, Jesse.
How you doing?
Pretty good, thanks. And Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Hi, Rick.
Hey, great to be with you.
Good to have you. And let's start with you, Rick, with this tape from Wednesday, when a reporter asked President Trump whether he'd respect the election results and commit to a peaceful transfer of power.
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
And, I understand that, but people are rioting. Do you commit to making sure that there's a peaceful transfer of power?
We want to have get rid of the ballots, and you'll have a very we'll have a very peaceful. There won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation.
Rick, how serious is this coming from a U.S. president?
It's an extraordinary moment. Never that we can identify has a president openly said he may not commit to respecting the outcome of an election. I think you put it in the context of other efforts that he is engaged in to actively undermine trust in the voting process, to try to influence the voting process itself, even as voting has started in more than a dozen states. And it is an alarming proposition. Whether he's serious about it or not is, to my mind, almost beside the point. This is a president on the record saying it. There's an easy way and a right way that almost any other president would answer this and say, yes, of course, I'll respect it. But there is this important caveat that he's put out there that I think is now hanging over everything that happens over the last 5-6 weeks of this campaign.
And here's what Joe Biden is saying about it.
I'm being facetious. I said, what country are we in? Look, he says the most irrational things. I don't know what to say about it, but it does surprise me.
Jesse, Biden kind of at a loss of words there. At this point, considering what the president has been saying for weeks now, as Rick alluded to, should we just assume that the campaign strategy is to decide this election at the Supreme Court?
Well, it sure seems like it's headed that way. President Trump is always trying to stack the deck in his favor. And this is his hedge against a groundswell of voters coming out to vote against him and not want to worry about coronavirus. If you look at some of the early voting numbers out of the states that are already voting, you'll see a huge swell of Democrats coming out. And so he's trying to work right now to invalidate those votes because he knows that a whole bunch of those votes will be against him. Now, the question becomes, will anyone else in power actually pay attention to him? We've already seen Republicans speak out against this crazy statement that the president's making. The question is, where will the military fall? Where will the Secret Service fall? When and if President Trump loses this election and actually goes through with this, I think this is just him trying to stack the deck right now. And when the time comes, he'll likely do the right thing. But man, is this dangerous? He could be causing riots in this country after the election's over.
Well, let's look at where the Senate is falling and what it did yesterday when it passed a unanimous resolution promising its support of a peaceful transition of power. I'd like to hear from both of you on this. Every Republican senator supported that resolution. But why do you think it is? Rick, why don't you go first? Why do you think it is that they did not call out the president by name on the issue if they are truly offended by what he said?
Frankly, I think they're weary of having to do so, and I think desensitized a little bit to a president who just says wild and outlandish things and has moved the bar for himself quite successfully. That the Republicans don't even feel like there's an upside for them anymore in stating the obvious, because it is the obvious. And look, I do not believe, I almost cannot believe that this president would stay in office if he loses the election. And I think that's kind of the tone that so many Republicans took. But we've been through this drill so many times before. The president says something outrageous. We all rightfully run to ask people to explain or defend. And I almost think that they have baked in the cake the fact that this president will say things that are outlandish, irrational, may not mean them, and frankly are often sometimes dangerous. Will they in the end stand if they need to? I don't know the answer to that. I think the bipartisan vote is maybe one signal around it, but I just think they are probably as weary as the rest of us of hearing a president who just does and says things that are just so far outside the norm of what we've expected.
Jesse, if there is this weariness, is this fear?
Well, keep in mind that the Republicans who have been weary and been all this time backing away from the things President Trump has said, they've actually gotten what they wanted. They're going to get another Supreme Court justice from President Trump. They now think all of this is worth it. Because why should they back away from President Trump? Why should they stand up against President Trump? One of the things they wanted was to keep President Obama from putting a Merrick Garland on the court and save that seat for whoever was the next president. That's President Trump. In the end, they've gotten what they wanted. They've gotten that extra Supreme Court seat. So why should they go out on a limb right now? Because he has gotten them what they wanted over the last 4 years.
To that point, Jesse, this is all happening at a very somber moment as Ruth Bader Ginsburg's body is lying in state at the Capitol today. Even as her memory is being honored, the president is expected to give us a name on his nominee is tomorrow. You know, we know the Senate likely has the votes to confirm whomever it is. But what are you going to be watching for, you know, in the next 24 hours? Once that name comes out, what are you going to be watching for? Where's this going next?
Well, once that name comes out, and this will be the fourth Supreme Court nomination that I will have covered for a organization. And once that name comes out, the wheels will be turning. Now, everyone's talking about the question of whether they'll get this nomination in before Election Day. Frankly, Election Day is a good target for people to look at, but the real target that you have to consider is actually, one, the inauguration of a new Senate in January, and two, the inauguration of possibly a new president. So while Republicans may be rushing to get it done before Election Day, their real target are those two dates, when a new Senate comes in and if the Senate changes during the election and when the president is inaugurated and whether the president changes. Those, I think the whole idea behind the Election Day confirmation might be a bit of a ruse because, you know what, that's not the target that really matters.
And Rick, I guess there's a question about how this will affect the race. Weigh in on the state of the race now. New polls showing Joe Biden close to even with Trump in states like Iowa and Georgia, kind of a surprise there, but then losing some of his advantage in key states like Arizona and Florida and North Carolina. What are you seeing?
Well, critical is all the states you just mentioned are actually states that President Trump won last time and critically needs to win again. He does not President Trump for a second term if he loses really any of those states in all likelihood. He is still fighting this he's fighting a re-election battle on his own turf, and he needs to play defense in all these places. And for all of the instability of the last year or so in this race and even the last couple of weeks, there's a remarkable stability in the polls, a national polling lead that has been relatively stable for Joe Biden, a narrow but decisive edge in the battleground states, including the biggies of Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, the three that really put him over the top. So if we're talking about states like Florida and North Carolina and Arizona and Iowa and Ohio and Georgia, those are all places that are red states effectively. And if Trump doesn't win those, he gets blown out in this election. And that, I think, is the reality of the race at this moment. Doesn't mean it stays, but that's where we are now.
Jesse, Joe Biden's messaging in public is still pretty much focused on the pandemic and on health care. How much is he gaining traction on those issues?
Well, especially as the numbers of the people who have died from coronavirus go up, I think we hit 200,000 this week, it will become more and more apparent that this election will be around healthcare, around the economy, and frankly, this is an election about President Trump. And if he keeps the focus on those three things, it puts him in a very good position moving forward. But then there's also that fourth thing that I think you'll hear more and more about as we get closer to the election day, and that's voter suppression. So that it doesn't matter how well Joe Biden does in the polls if he can't get voters to come out and vote for him that on election day, or he can't get those voters who go out can't get their votes counted in those key states. So I think that's one of the things that he has to worry about more than anything else, not just the economy, not just coronavirus, but getting voters to go vote and making sure those votes are counted.
All those issues are going to come up next Tuesday. And holy cow, the first debate is here. Rick, we have less than a minute here, but what are you expecting to see or what are you watching for on Tuesday in Cleveland?
I think there's going to be so much more pressure on Joe Biden, frankly, you know, leading right now. But so many Democrats are still concerned about his candidacy in various ways. And we know that Donald Trump's going to do unpredictable things. The question is how Biden responds to it. Does he go back tit for tat in terms of name calling? Does he try to fact check him? I feel like he's got a lot on the line, even though he's got this narrow edge that we talked about.
All right. Rick Klein, political director at ABC News, and Jesse Holland, weekend host at C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Like most industries, solar has taken a hit during the pandemic. Residential solar panel installations in the U.S. were down nearly 25% in the second quarter of the year after a record-breaking start to 2020. Last year, solar accounted for 40% of all new electricity capacity in the U.S. Let's check in now on the state of the solar industry with Ravi Mangani, head of solar research at Wood Mackenzie. Robbie, welcome. And how badly did the pandemic slow down solar?
So while the solar installations, especially in the residential sector, were hit real hard, since then we have seen the market pick up, and we'll end up still down compared to what we had initially projected at the beginning of the year. But the residential segment, for instance, will end up being about 9 to 10% below our initial expectation.
Pre-COVID, things were going, you know, pretty well. Last year, solar accounted for a greater share of all new generating capacity in the U.S. compared to any other power source. And most of that, it looks like, is coming from utility-scale power plants. As your firm points out, even during the pandemic, the U.S. solar market installed 3.5 gigawatts of new solar capacity. Talk about that. Where are those new solar plants coming from and who's leading the way?
You're right, Peter, that you know the utility scale segment or the big solar farms account for majority of the solar installations in the country. The net result is that like states like Texas and Florida continue to see record amounts of solar installation, particularly in the utility segment, but in other parts of the industry too.
Is that because of cost? You know, in the last 15 years, we see that solar has gone from about $1 per kilowatt hour to just like 4 cents per kilowatt hour today. Is that what's driving the surge?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we think about why solar has become such a mainstay for generation technologies, we come down to two pillars, right? One of them is, of course, climate action, but the other obvious one is economics. It is the cheapest form of generation today, even compared to natural gas. So the number that he said, you know, about 3 to 4 cents per kilowatt hour, compared that to natural gas, which is about a cent or so higher. And it's, you know, once we start to look at coal or nuclear, solar wins, you know, head and shoulders above both those technologies.
Mm. Well, now you're getting into some interesting territory here, because if you look at the breakdown in 2019 of where power came from in the United States, 38% from natural gas, 23% from coal, nuclear, 20%. And then renewables, 17%. So if solar is getting so cheap, why is it still at the bottom of that list?
Yeah, so one thing to keep in mind, right? Solar has been consistently the largest or the fastest growing new technology in the past few years. We are talking about an industry where these generation assets are expected to last 50 years or more in some instances. What is interesting here is, you know, as solar continues to sort of climb up in the generation mix, as costs keep going down, by 2050, it's going to be, in fact, the largest installed base, more than three times the next generation technology, which wouldn't, even by 2050, still be gas.
That's Ravi Mangani, head of solar research at Wood Mackenzie. Ravi, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Well, now to a place where the sun shines round the clock in the summer and then not at all in the winter. the North Pole. A group of researchers from 20 countries is about to finish what they're calling the largest polar expedition in history. The icebreaker Polar Stern set out from Norway in September of last year and is due back in just a few weeks. Over the past year, scientists on board have been circling the North Pole, collecting data in the Arctic Ocean to better understand the loss of polar ice and climate change. The leader of that expedition is with us now. Professor Marcus Rex is aboard the Polar Stern. Professor, hello, and first of all, where in the world are you right now?
We are still pretty close to the North Pole. At right now, it's 88.5 degrees north, and that is off the Siberian coast in the Siberian sector of the Arctic, pretty close to the North Pole.
Wow, and that would explain the sound of your connection right there. It's, you're on a scratchy satellite phone. Not a lot of people have had the chance to be where you are, to be at the North Pole. What's it like? What are you noticing?
It is still fascinating to be at the North Pole and to be here that late during the year. It's getting time to get out of here. The sun here at these latitudes, it's amazing. The sun just circles around you and just follows your horizon for hours and hours without changing its altitude above the horizon. It's fascinating. But it's also a bit shocking. We have large stretches of very thin ice and even open water on our way back now. That's good for traveling through the ice, but it also shows how dramatic climate change already is here up in the high north.
Well, tell me more about that, because it's been a very hot year in the Arctic, as you well know. Tell me more about the conditions of the ice and what the summer did to it up there.
That's true. The summer here in the Arctic has been extremely warm. Just a few decades ago, the Arctic was covered with mighty annual thick and very solid sea ice. Now it's covered with only 1 or 2 year old, very thin and very ice floes. And therefore, we can travel through the Arctic when in previous years it would have been hard to even get through this region.
You've said this is the first time a research icebreaker has spent a full year at the North Pole, including the Arctic winter. Why did you need to spend a whole year up there and not break it up into smaller trips?
It's just not possible to travel through the Arctic in winter. The ice in winter, even nowadays, is too thick to we can't break into it with our research icebreakers. The only way to get here is to get here in summer or fall, then let the vessel freeze into the ice. And then we drifted with the natural drift of the ice across the North Pole area. That's the only way to get here. And the other reason is that our climate models need to run the full year, and we want to improve the representation of the climate processes here in the Arctic in our climate models. And that means that we need a full year of research, including winter and summer season.
Wow. So what is it like to live on that research vessel for a year while you're drifting stuck in the ice? So, I mean, what's life been like?
Winter in the Arctic is a very, very special experience. It is just completely black outside. The world shrinks to a little bubble of light you can see from your own flashlight. When you are out there walking over the landscape, the deeply frozen landscape of the sea ice of the Arctic, it's more like exploring a different planet, really. There aren't any colors. The snow and ice surface is completely white where the light from the flashlight gets, and it's completely pitch black and dark where it doesn't get. So you have these pressure ridges, formations several meters high of compressed ice, and in between you have the flat areas which are in the shadows of the ridges. It looks like being on a different planet, and sometimes it's hard to believe that this is still planet Earth.
Wow. What did that do for your mental well-being, your emotional well-being, to live like that for so long?
Sometimes people think that would be depressing to live in complete darkness for half a year. Actually, it's not. It's very inspiring. I think everybody on board felt that enthusiasm to be able to be here, to be able to experience that world which so few people have experienced so far. And we have spent so much time as we could out there on the ice in the complete darkness to just completely take it in.
Wow, unbelievable. Now, I'm also thinking that a lot has happened since your ship went out to sea last September, including, of course, the onset of a global pandemic. What was it like to watch that unfold while you were in, I think isolation would be the right word, on this vessel in the Arctic?
the pandemic was a nightmare for our expedition. The reason is that not in winter, but in fall and spring and summer, we needed delivery of fuel and provisions from partner icebreakers. Altogether, we had 6 additional vessels which supported the expedition. Another interesting aspect is that we are completely corona-free here. It's a little corona-free paradise up here in the Arctic. We can party together. We don't have any social distancing rules. It's really like a little heaven.
Mm. Look, if most people could see what you've seen over the past year, could take this trip to the North Pole like you have, do you think it would change people's perspective on climate change? What's the impact of being up there?
I think it would. And that is why we also seek communicating about what we have seen and experienced here as an integral part of what we are doing. We need to show people how dramatic the changes in the Arctic are already now. Here in the Arctic, you don't need sophisticated statistical analyzers or sophisticated measurement equipment to detect climate change. When I started to travel to the Arctic in the early 1990s, it was a deeply frozen landscape in winter, just snow and ice, as you would imagine the Arctic in winter. When I get there today, I have open water right at my feet. The fjord, our station is located at the coastline of the fjord, has not frozen over for the past decade, and we go by boats nowadays where we used to do skiing trips or trips with snowmobiles. It's dramatic. It's impressive. I think it shows the urgency of our political measures now to mitigate climate change.
That's Professor Marcus Rex, head of atmospheric physics at the Alfred Wegener Institute and leader of the Arctic Expedition Mosaic, about to return to port after a year circling the North Pole to study climate change. Professor Rex, thank you so much for speaking with us. When you get off that ship, you're going to be entering a very changed world. So thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for your interest, and have a nice day.
The United Kingdom is dealing with a new surge of COVID-19. Health officials yesterday reported 6,600 new infections. It's the highest daily figure since mass testing started. NPR's Frank Langfitt joins us now from the streets of Weybridge, just west of London. And Frank, start with those numbers. What's going on? Is this a second wave?
Well, you know, about a week ago, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, said we were, at the risk of heading towards a second wave. And certainly these numbers, they are increasing really, really rapidly. And it seems like we're heading towards one very much. It's hard to know what is the technical definition of a second wave, but certainly it feels that way. And there's a lot of concern because this summer things went really well here. Life was largely back to normal. And now people, I think, are very anxious because they see these numbers rising and are worried really about heading towards a possible lockdown again.
Yeah, and here's Prime Minister Boris Johnson speaking this week in the House of Commons.
We always knew that while we might have driven the virus into retreat, the prospect of a second wave was real. And I'm sorry to say that as in Spain and France and many other countries, we've reached a perilous turning point.
Frank, perilous turning point, kind of ominous. What's Boris Johnson doing about it?
Well, he's put in a number of measures. So on Thursday night here in England, the pubs had to start closing at 10 o'clock instead of later. Sometimes it'll be 11:30 out where I am, sometimes considerably later in London. And what we're also seeing some changes in other parts of the country. Up in Scotland, different households can no longer hang out together. And also up in Scotland, they've told university students that they should stay away from the pubs this weekend. So it's sort of slower measures. And the concern, I think, from some scientists and ordinary people here is that it won't be enough to slow this very rapid rise and that we're just going to see more and more measures coming online pretty soon.
And I can hear you're on the streets of Weybridge right now, as we said, just west of London. How are people responding, businesses responding there where you are?
Well, right now, what's really interesting is it almost feels like a lull before a second storm. This place looks, I'm on what they call the high street. It's a main street, not unlike what you'd see in America. And there are lots of people out, lots of cars. Almost all the stores are open. I see, okay, here's a woman who's crossing the street with a mask, but most people are not wearing masks. And so it feels normal, but my concern would be that within a few weeks, this could look really different, that a lot of stores could be closing down or in much shorter hours. and that's where I think people are here. And I guess the concern that Johnson and others have is that the economy has been recovering for 3 months, and their concern is if he, his concern would be if he puts on more measures soon, it's just going to slow down that recovery, maybe kill it.
What about the rest of Europe?
The rest of Europe, it varies. I mean, there's definitely, we're seeing surges, particularly in France. I believe the most recent figures are 16,000 a day, and there's a lot of concern there. On the other hand, a place like Germany that got very high marks for Angela Merkel's leadership there, sort of very technocratic approach to COVID-19, I think it was 2,300 the last numbers I saw. And I was just on the phone with a professor who normally works here in England, who's in Berlin. I was interviewing him on a separate topic, and I said, so when you head back? And he says, I don't want to come back. He said from his perspective, he sees this definitely as a second wave. He's not happy, as many people are not happy with Boris Johnson's leadership, and he wants to stay in Germany as long as he can.
That's NPR's Frank Linkfit on the streets of Weybridge, England. Thanks very much for your time and good luck.
Hey, thanks, man. Good to talk.
Facebook is removing three disinformation networks with ties to Russia. Facebook says the networks were mostly focusing on Europe and Asia, but they were reaching the U.S. too. One of the affiliated blogs was called Black and Intelligent. It promoted U.S. news articles that were critical of Joe Biden and favorable toward Bernie Sanders. The presidential election is just 39 days away, and both the CIA and FBI say this kind of foreign interference will continue. But there is a newer form that experts are also concerned about, and that's domestic. In Phoenix, Arizona, a group of young conservatives has been getting paid to post misinformation about the election and about the coronavirus. Their support comes from a group called Turning Point USA. Turning Point's 26-year-old founder Charlie Kirk opened up the Republican National Convention this summer. Kirk's social media operation was first discovered by the Washington Post, and it has some experts worried. They say it marks the birth of domestic troll farms or paid propagandists. Graham Brookie is director of the Digital Forensic Research Laboratory at the Atlantic Council. Welcome, Graham.
Thank you so much for having me.
The young people who generated these messages on social media wrote, for instance, that mail-in ballots will lead to fraud this election, a statement for which there is no evidence. According to the Washington Post story, a tweet claimed that coronavirus numbers have been intentionally inflated. Remind us who's doing the posting and how it's being paid for.
Well, the Washington Post found that this troll farm is actually being run by teenagers, in some cases minors, outside of Phoenix, Arizona. It's technically tied to a 501c4 nonprofit called, as you mentioned, Turning Point USA. And it appears as though some of the posters are being paid for their posts.
So what can you tell us about Turning Point USA and what they're doing in Arizona?
Well, it appears as though they're trying to generate as much social media engagement around some of the messages that you just mentioned, which are what we would consider to be disinformation, most notably about voting by mail, some related to coronavirus. And that shouldn't be new. For instance, there are a number of blogs as well as media outlets that do the same. But the tactic of using contract employment, especially with much younger people, including minors, is very concerning.
Much younger people and minors, especially in the United States, because we're used to hearing about this kind of thing coming from Russia or 4 years ago from some teenagers in Macedonia. Are there many examples of it happening here in the United States?
There aren't that many examples of this happening here in the United States. To my knowledge, the report from Washington Post is one of the first reported instances. As you said, in 2016, we were very concerned about Macedonian teenagers writing clickbait news that included false information or disinformation. And this in this election cycle in 2020, we have to be concerned about that same type of activity being done here in the United States.
When you call it a troll farm, what do we know about how troll farms operate? Are these young people together in a room getting the message from, for instance, Turning Point USA saying, here, write about this, here, write about something else, and by the way, don't say where you're getting the information or the fact that this is not just your own opinion?
I think that your description is exactly right. A troll farm indicates a degree of coordination, a degree of kind of editorial control. And in general, what we know about this network is that they were responding on social media to people like journalists. And so when we talk about trolling, there's kind of this call and response. One of the other components of what this network apparently was doing was copy and pasting the same message in order to drive up as much engagement on that message and to make it look like it was more popular than it likely really was. That is what we mean by disinformation or the intentional spread of false information.
And Turning Point USA says basically they're not sponsoring a troll farm. They're simply adapting to the coronavirus pandemic and paying people to do their jobs online that they would have otherwise paid them to do in the field. Is there any credibility to that? I mean, what are they saying that these young people would have been doing in the field?
Well, that activity in the field would have much smaller audience reach because it would be person-to-person engagement. It would be things like knocking on doors. And online, you get a much broader audience. And so when you're tipping up that social media engagement, you can measure exactly how many people you're reaching with that message. And that is the point where they're trying to go truly viral. And if it includes disinformation, for instance, disinformation about voting by mail in an election that is happening in the middle of a pandemic, that's extremely concerning activity.
Well, Twitter and Facebook seem to be concerned because they have suspended some of the accounts. What are the grounds they have for yanking the accounts?
It's unclear what grounds a few of the accounts were removed from Facebook and Twitter. But Facebook and Twitter have both indicated that they're on high alert for process disinformation, and that's disinformation about A, the results of the election, or B, where, when, and how to vote, as well as very concerned and moderating a lot of content around coronavirus disinformation or disinformation about the very real public health crisis that we still have in this country.
Is there, by the way, any evidence that the Republican Party itself is at all involved in funding this kind of operation or funding Turning Point USA?
I'm not entirely sure. What I can say is that Turning Point USA is directly aligned and very supportive of President Trump. Its founder, Charlie Kirk, is a large youth supporter of Donald Trump. He's attended multiple rallies with the Trump campaign. He's an outspoken advocate and surrogate for the campaign. And so the amplification to a larger audience, regardless of the source of funding, is the same.
Do we know if there's a similar effort happening on the part of Democrat Joe Biden?
There is no indication that a similar effort is happening on behalf of Joe Biden. First and foremost, Joe Biden is running a campaign that also includes a number of digital elements because of the transition to coronavirus. But Joe Biden doesn't engage in disinformation as a strategy, and there is no evidence for that.
Graham, are we more vulnerable to disinformation coming from the United States, from within our borders, than foreign misinformation? Because you might have read the article by Joshua Yaffa in The New Yorker recently. The piece was called, "Is Russian Meddling as Dangerous as We Think?" And he posed the question, what if, to borrow an old horror movie trope, the call is coming from inside the house? Could domestic misinformation be a greater threat than foreign?
That's absolutely right. The scale and scope of domestic disinformation is far greater than anything a foreign adversary could do to us. And further to that point, online influence operations from foreign adversaries that include disinformation can only be successful in targeting domestic audiences if those domestic audiences already have a very robust supply and demand of domestic disinformation. Now, that doesn't dismiss the fact that Russia's efforts and other foreign adversaries' efforts remain an extremely serious national security vulnerability in which democracy itself is the target.
So how is the United States to responsibly cut the amount of disinformation if you say that the populace is already vulnerable to it, as we've seen in the past?
Well, it's up to every single one of us. Every single one of us needs to be a little bit more resilient. When we're engaging with content online, we need to have a healthy degree of skepticism. We need to look at the sources of information and, frankly, the source of information when we're looking online. We're going to have a very confusing election season. We're having an election season in which voting is happening in a way that isn't necessarily typical given the pandemic. And so looking for specific, reliable, accountable, transparent sources of information is going to be absolutely crucial. And that's not something that we can rely on social media platforms for. It's not something that we can rely on media outlets for. or even candidates. That's something that we have to rely on ourselves for. We all have a role to play in that. And so looking to sources like secretaries of state for official election results is going to be incredibly important.
Thank you very much for talking with us. Graham Brookey is director of the Digital Forensic Research Lab at the Atlantic Council. Nice to speak with you, Graham.
Thanks for having me.
Members of a Native tribe will soon be in a Canadian courtroom trying to prove they exist. The Sinaiax tribe from northern Washington state used to live in both Canada and the U.S., routinely crossing what is now an international border. But more than half a century ago, their numbers in Canada dwindled to a point where the Canadian government declared them extinct. And early next month, American members of the tribe will take the unprecedented step of trying to reverse that ruling. The CBC's Bob Keating has our story from British Columbia.
This is a sturgeon nose canoe.
Sinaiax tribal member Shelley Boyd paddles a homemade canoe on Arrow Lake near Castlegar, British Columbia. Boyd says before miners, settlers, and the government pushed them out, these mountains and waterways were Sinaiax territory. This lake, one of their highways.
This is our territory. This is where we have been from time immemorial. And nothing changes the fact that my tupia, my old grandmothers and my own grandfathers from both of the sides of my family were born on the edges of these rivers.
European settlement in this rugged corner of Canada was devastating to the native people who lived here, but particularly the Sinaiax. Western diseases killed them, miners searching for gold and silver, then immigrant farmers pushed them off their land.
It was a brutal, intentional, methodical push to get us out of the Upper Columbia Basin.
Sinaiax numbers dwindled to a handful, confined to a tiny reserve on the edge of this lake. The Canadian government claimed the last Sinaiax died in the 1950s, and took the rare step of striking them from the Federal Indian Act as it began planning hydroelectric projects on rivers and lakes here. The Sinaiax in Canada were declared extinct and did not have the numbers or energy to fight that declaration. Sinaiax historian Michael Finley.
You have a generation where it was something that was so hurtful they just didn't talk about it. I heard that a lot from my dad and even my grandparents, that there's just some things that they just didn't talk about.
The Sinaiax maintain they never truly were extinct, but driven south to a huge reserve created by the American government, the Colville Indian Reservation in Washington State. A dozen different tribes from the American West were resettled there. Then the U.S. government sold half the reservation to white settlers, much of it former Sinaiax territory. The Sinaiax pushed south again to a tiny settlement on the banks of the Columbia River called Inshilium. They were among the poorest citizens in the American West, but Sinaiax numbers grew. And a decade ago, they again turned their eyes to Canada, this time with a plan to try and reverse the declaration of extinction and reassert a form of sovereignty in the mountains of British Columbia, a place many Sinaiax had never seen. They sent tribal member Rick Desautel into BC to hunt an elk without a license.
My goal is just to go to Canada, just as my nomadic ancestors did, to go up there hunt and not have this 49th visible line saying I can't go to hunt there.
Hoping to spark a court case, Desautel turned himself in to Canadian officials. He was charged with hunting without a license and being a non-resident hunter. His case churned through the courts for almost 10 years, and the Sinaiax won at every level. The province of British Columbia appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada, arguing the cases of national significance. And next month, Canada's highest court will hear the precedent-setting Sinaiax story, and a people will argue their very existence.
You can't ignore the history. It has to be acknowledged what happened, and some of that is being recognized through the court system, through the battles that we fought through the Desautel case. I think we're able to really bring that to light on how it resulted in us being down here.
Our land is beautiful.
There is one last final irony to the Sinaiax unusual journey. Their case was supposed to be heard this past spring. The COVID-19 pandemic shut down the border and the Canadian court system. Though the case will be heard in Ottawa, the Sinaiax themselves will not be there. They may have to follow arguments about their existence via the internet back in Inshilium, Washington.
being told in a thousand different ways that you don't matter by society, it adds up.
Still, the case has sweeping implications for the Sinaiaks and other tribes with connections to both sides of the border. And Shelley Boyd says after a half century of official extinction in Canada, her people's voices will again be heard.
Rick Dizitel, standing up for our people and going out to harvest that elk in the name of our people and having to acknowledge his existence acknowledges all of us and acknowledges history and acknowledges the fact that you can't just declare people extinct because they're inconvenient.
For Here and Now, I'm Bob Keating in British Columbia.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now.